first of our second series of lectures in the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. I found a member of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, now unfortunately working in Edinburgh, but back here at every available moment. And it gives me very great pleasure tonight to welcome Professor Andrew Steptoe. When we first began to think about the Glasgow Centre, we really challenged ourselves to try and come up with a different paradigm of thinking about health inequalities and how social and economic status impacts on health. And critical in that thinking was the work that Professor Andrew Steptoe and his colleagues, Sir Michael Marmot, another name that you will know, have done over the years. Andrew is a graduate of both Oxford and Cambridge, and he's worked extensively in London as a lecturer in psychology and more recently researching in University College London on the relationship between psychology, social status and health. And the papers he's produced have helped us really begin to shape our thinking of how Glasgow's health is formed. So I'm very excited to hear what he's got to say tonight. We're very grateful for him for coming, and I just, without any further ado, ask him to come and speak to us.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm delighted to be here. It's been a few years since I've been in Glasgow, but every time I come it seems to be getting nicer and nicer for a poor southerner like me. I'm going to talk about the work that we're doing in psychobiological research in this whole area, and I must say, just hearing this afternoon about the Glasgow Centre, I'm very impressed by the integrated approach that is being planned and that is taking place here. I'm from University College in London, and that's how it looks on sunnier days. Founded, as some of you will know, in about 1826 under the precepts of the utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham, whose principles really led to some of the basic kind of principles behind University College. And it's interesting that in England it was the first university to admit non-Protestants, to admit Catholics. It was the first university to admit Jewish people, and the first university to admit people from the Far East. And so it was always quite an eclectic place. And Jeremy Bentham, being a utilitarian, wanted to use things to the maximum, including using his own body for dissection. And he decided before he died that, obviously before he died, that he would that he'd donate his body for dissection, because at that time the only people who dissected, technically anyway, apart from Burke and Hare's kind of activities, were criminals. And so this was relatively unusual for a middle class gentleman. But afterwards he also decreed that his body should be reconstituted and put in this box, and where it sits outside the library at UCL, and indeed it does to this day. So this is Jeremy Bentham himself. It's a bit kind of creepy as you go past him every day. The head over there on the right-hand side is actually a wax one. They did used to have the head in the box as well, but students from other colleges kept stealing it, and you know, Mary Japes of medical students, and it ended up in the quad, and so now it's only brought out on high days and holidays. But in some sense, the principles behind Bentham's thinking and this sort of egalitarian nature of the college has persisted to some extent in the department in which I work now, which is, as Harry said, is directed by Michael Marmot, which has been involved with a number of studies, and these are the current population studies that are run in one sense or another from the department, a number of studies to do with social factors in particular and health outcomes, including of course the Whitehall studies, which are the studies I'm going to be that I do my work within, but also a number of other types of investigation that we're also involved with. And the broad context of what we try to do is really outlined in this rather grandiose slide, which Michael generated, which starts at social structure on the top left and ends with disease and health at the bottom right. And it's really trying to fill in the various aspects, both in terms of population epidemiological studies of the social environment and particularly the work environment, but also some of these other processes down at this end. And this is really the part that I'm going to be talking about much more this evening, how these processes, these social factors, actually get under your skin and influence physical disease outcomes and physical health, and what we can do to try and integrate those biological studies into a population framework. What I'd like to do this evening is to talk about these four issues here in one way or another, and we'll see how we get on in terms of time. I'm going to describe very briefly things which many of you will already know about, so I'm not going to dwell long on them, which is to do with psychosocial factors in relation to physical health outcomes. Then say rather more about what we mean by psychobiological processes and what they are, and then about how, what sort of methods we can use to investigate those, and in particular how we can link those in to population studies in order to try and look at social, demographic and other types of environmental exposures. And then lastly, to say something about how what we know so far about how these responses actually relate to health outcomes. Well, let me start off with the issue of psychosocial factors and physical illness. It'll be well known to you, coming from Glasgow, because there are large socio-economic disparities in this part of the world, that in a way the most basic kind of psychosocial factor or social factor is social position. And this is an older slide using the older Registrar General's classification of people by occupation, with one being the professional groups and five being the unskilled manual groups, showing the premature mortality rates in men between the ages of 20 and 64. And there are three different census cohorts included on this slide, showing that, if anything, the gradient has got worse. Psychosocial factors, of course, go beyond socioeconomic status, although many of the other social factors, psychosocial factors, are socially graded. And the ones that we typically look at, I would tend to divide out into these three broad categories. One are something to do with various types of chronic life stress exposure to unpleasant or difficult conditions over long-term periods. The second are features of the social environment to do with social connectedness and social support, those sorts of factors which are by and large protective, of course, the connectedness factors. And then there are a number of more psychological factors which are thought to be important as well, which include depression, but also some other aspects of what might broadly be described as negative emotions. I'm going just briefly to touch on some of the evidence which relates these to physical health, and I'll do that by illustrating through the area which I work in primarily, which is coronary heart disease, mainly because that is my work, is a lot of it is sponsored by the British Heart Foundation, but also because this is remains one of the major causes of mortality and morbidity in this country, and there is a strong social gradient in this, so it's of considerable interest. Coronary heart disease, of course, has a number of well-known risk factors, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, diabetes, and cigarette smoking. Nonetheless, it's interesting to note that a substantial number of people actually end up having coronary heart disease who don't have high levels of known risk factors. And this is illustrated in this slide here, which is a compendium, really, from some 15 prospective randomized controlled trials in literature, just looking at the prevalence of conventional risk factors, the four conventional major risk factors, which are smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes, in a group of nearly 90,000 patients with coronary heart disease. And what's quite interesting is that most of these patients don't have very many risk factors. There's about just under 20% who have no recognized risk factors, and another large chunk, nearly half the people, don't have more than one. So that could be just people who are smoking, for example, or people who have high blood pressure without having the other factors. So although these risk factors clearly are important, they're not accounting for all the mortality and morbidity in this area. And this is one reason why we look at these kind of psychosocial factors as well. Well, to take an example, first of all, from the area of exposure to life stress, A lot of work is done on work stress, as many of you here will know. One reason for that being, of course, that many people spend, who are fortunate enough to be in paid employment, do spend a great deal of their time at work, and so the exposure is prolonged over years and decades of life, and so there could well be influences that influence physical health outcome. This is just one example of the association between work stress and future cardiac mortality. These slides all have the same sort of format. That is, the factor, the putative risk factor, was studied at baseline, and then people were followed up for various numbers of years. In this particular case, 25 years. The outcome in this case here is cardiac mortality. And what's shown here are the relative risks associated with being low or high on that risk factor after controlling for a number of other things which are also known, of course, to influence CHD and cardiac mortality. In this particular slide, what's shown is the one particular model of work stress, which is the relationship between the amount of effort people put in and the amount of reward that they gain from their work. And those people who seem to have a greater imbalance in this, that is, they put in a great deal of effort for little reward, are at higher risk, approximately twice the risk over this 25-year period. This is a study of men from Finland. And what's interesting is that this association is independent of the regular established cardiovascular risk factors, and also of some of the behaviours which are also relevant to cardiovascular disease, such as body mass and physical activity. An example from the area of social factors and social integration is provided here. In this particular case, this is incidence of new cases of people with coronary heart disease. So at the beginning, they were disease-free, followed up over a 15-year period. And there are two different classifications here. One is based on a measure of social integration. So these people here are socially isolated, and these people have high levels of social connectedness, and so the risk goes down with people who have higher levels of social connectedness compared with those who are more socially isolated. On the right-hand side is a measure of emotional attachment, more supportive aspects of the social environment rather than just the structural aspects of the social environment, again showing that people with greater emotional attachment are at lower risk. And then the third example is from the domain of psychological experience, and in relation to cardiovascular disease, one of the main interests of recent years has been in depression, not just clinical depression, but also subclinical depressions and elevated levels of depressive symptomatology. And this slide here is showing relative risk over a 10-year period in people who were not depressed at the beginning compared to those who were depressed at the beginning, in both men and women, with an increase of about 50% in the likelihood of developing new cardiovascular disease, again controlling for risk factors, including social factors such as poverty. Now, there are a whole host of studies like this, and I'm not going to continue with this kind of litany, but just to point out one or two other effects, not so much to do with the cardiovascular endpoint, but with another issue which I think is particularly interesting in the area of psychobiology and becoming of increasing interest altogether as far as cardiovascular and other diseases are concerned, which is the metabolic syndrome. This is a syndrome of a series of risk factors which are essentially to do with adiposity, that's body weight, particularly around the waist, together with disturbances in lipids, that's high levels of triglycerides and low levels of HDL cholesterol, which is the good cholesterol, disturbances of glucose metabolism and high blood pressure. And this constellation or syndrome has been of increasing interest because it relates not only to coronary heart disease but also to the development of type 2 diabetes, which is of course becoming increasingly important in Great Britain. And here is just one example of the sorts of, again, another kind of prospective population study looking at the relationship between the metabolic syndrome and another form of what we might call chronic stress, which is to do with marital satisfaction. This is a follow-up over 11 years of women only, looking at the likelihood of the development of metabolic syndrome, controlling for, obviously, their initial disease state, and risk factor state, comparing those who said they were very satisfied with their marital situation, those who are moderately, and then the dissatisfied ones, who are at substantially elevated risk. Interestingly, again, controlling for things like physical activity and alcohol consumption and smoking, and also for education, so some kind of control for socioeconomic position. Now, the thing about all these factors, which is relevant especially to the psychobiological argument, is that these are what I'd call chronic challenges. They're not acute stresses in people's lives. These are things which go on month in, month out, year in, year out, often over decades. And so they may be influences on the long-term development of disease rather than on some single acute manifestation. And so we may be looking at relatively small but persistent differences in mechanisms, which are what psychobiological responses are, that could be contributing to this increase in risk. Not, you know, very exaggerated and grand and easily to observe kind of responses, but quite small differences that we should be looking for. And the other thing to point out, of course, is that when we talk about these factors, we're not talking about them these as the cause of these kind of physical illnesses, but as contributors to risk, along with all the other factors that we know are important. So the question comes of what are the mechanisms? Now, when we talk about mechanism, of course, that can be understood at many different levels, at social levels, at structural levels, at economic levels, but also, in one way or another, whatever happens in the outside environment or in your brain, it's got to influence the physical disease processes in the end. It's got to get down inside to alter things in the blood, to alter things in terms of cardiovascular activity or gastrointestinal activity or something like that. And it's at that sort of level, right down at the level of how things kind of get installed within the biology, which is, I'm going to discuss. And when we think about that, there are really two broad sets of mechanisms that we typically think of. One is that, in one way or another, these sorts of psychosocial adversities may influence people's habits. So may be associated with less healthy habits in terms of things like smoking or food choice leading to high levels of fat intake, sedentary behavior, and so forth. So that people, for example, under work stress or people who are socially isolated may have less prudent lifestyles, which could then contribute to disease outcomes. Now, to some extent, that is, of course, true. The literature is actually quite a complicated one, relating those lifestyle behavioral processes with psychosocial factors, but there is certainly some evidence for these things. The most striking case, of course, would be smoking in relation to socioeconomic position, which is a very strong gradient in this country. However, most of the slides that I've been showing you, if you've been having a look at the bottom left corner, you'll see we're trying to control for many of these sorts of behavioral risk factors, and so the effects I showed you were, as it were, independent of these kind of lifestyle processes, suggesting that something else more fundamental or more biological might be going on, and that's what the psychobiological approach is to do with. It's to do with, essentially, with modifications, more direct modifications, from the psychosocial environment into the biology, through neuroendocrine pathways, cardiovascular pathways, immunological pathways, and other physiological responses. So I'm going to go on in the next section to say a little bit about what these processes are. I know that many people here are not so familiar with biology, so I'll try to keep this fairly broad, but it is important that you try and understand that I try and explain what the processes are. Essentially, what we're talking about are the links between the brain, the neocortex, the bit which does our thinking, decision-making, planning, memory, and so forth, and the biological systems, the physiology. And essentially, this is driven through the rather more primitive areas of the brain, in particular areas known as the limbic system, which is a phylogenetically rather primitive area, including such things as the hippocampus, the amygdala, and so forth, and also this area, the hypothalamus, all of which are right inside, as it were, near the top of the brain stem, which is coming up inside here. And these areas are important in the regulation of various biological functions that we look at in terms of physiology. What sort of responses are we talking about? We're actually talking about quite a wide range of responses which can be manifest in many different systems. And this rather daunting list is just some of the processes that are looked at in this kind of work. And I won't be talking about all of them, but just to give you an idea that we're talking about quite broad integrated patterns of biological response which are related to people's behaviour and experience. A lot of this is integrated through neuroendocrine pathways, which I'm going to describe a little bit more in a moment. There are clearly quite a number of direct cardiovascular processes which are important, and increasingly important are these, what I call inflammatory processes. These are markers to do with the maybe relatively low levels of inflammation. Obviously, if you get some external kind of injury or pathogen, you may get an acute inflammation, a large inflammation. But what we're talking about here is more low-level kind of chronic inflammation, which is marked by such variables as C-reactive protein and interleukin IL-6. Then there are a number of changes in metabolic processes to do with cholesterol levels and lipid levels in the blood and the way in which glucose is metabolized. Some things to do with hemostatic, that's blood clotting processes, and then other areas of immune function. Now, this is quite a lot of responses, but it's relatively easy to understand because these things are integrated at the higher levels of the way in which the brain influences the response processes, and critical in that are these neuroendocrine and autonomic processes. And I'll just describe a couple of those. One key one is cortisol. Cortisol is a hormone which circulates through the blood, and it's synthesized in the adrenal gland. And it's been known for 50 years or so that its control is regulated from the brain, in particular from this area of the hypothalamus, which leads through a cascade of processes to the release of ACTH, corticotropin, as it's shown on this slide here, which circulates till it gets down to the adrenal gland, which is down near the kidneys, which then leads to the release of cortisol. And there's a very sophisticated feedback system, so the more cortisol you generate, you get inhibition going back up to the brain. There are two important features of this which I wanted to point out. One is that the function of this system, which is often regarded as a kind of self-regulated system, is influenced also by higher centers, in particular by emotional stimuli coming from the limbic system, which in turn relates to the neocortex. And the other thing is that cortisol itself has a whole series of effects on various tissues, the cardiovascular system, the liver, the adipose tissue, the fat tissue, and also the immune system, which is the way in which it may influence disease outcomes. Now, cortisol is released, of course, naturally, and it has a number of effects which are to do with the regulation of a whole series of different biological responses, many of which are to do with the preparation of the body for vigorous activity, for example, the release of fatty acids from fat stores, stimulation of glucose production in the liver, and other processes such as immune regulation and so forth. The second major pathway that is particularly relevant in psychobiological research is the sympathetic nervous system, which is one of the branches of the automatic or autonomic nervous system, which is again regulated through from the hypothalamus down through the brainstem, and has a number of effects on different systems, such as increasing the production of the stress hormones adrenaline and noradrenaline from the adrenals, alterations in cardiovascular function and breathing rate, and such things as blood clotting, which for some reason is depicted here by someone's eye. I don't quite understand why that might be. And again, this has a whole host of different kind of biological, peripheral biological effects. Well, these responses are elicited under natural conditions and are sometimes known as fight and flight responses, which are adapted to vigorous activity and to mobilization of the body and to doing something in conditions of danger and hazard. So one can ask, why are these responses hazardous? And there are really two major reasons for this. One is that these responses are actually repeatedly elicited in conditions of everyday life. So although they may have evolved to help us escape from tigers and mammoths and things like that, they are actually also elicited when we are stuck in traffic jams and our aeroplanes are late leaving for Glasgow, and those sorts of conditions, which will again, where vigorous physical activity is not really an appropriate response. So that's one thing, that these things are elicited at the wrong time, in the wrong place, and repeatedly in everyday life. And the second thing is that there are large individual differences in how people respond. And some people show heightened reactions, or what is proving increasingly important, a failure of post-stress adaptation. So following some challenge in life, some people, the system remains in a more elevated state for minutes or possibly hours after that stimulus. And under those conditions, these may contribute to the wear and tear, which will ultimately increase disease risk. And so one can look, again, I'm not going to go through a catalogue of these things, but there are potentially damaging effects of all these regulatory processes, and this I just illustrate for cortisol. These are some potentially damaging effects which have been established both in experimental studies but also clinically in studies of people who are unfortunate enough to have naturally high levels of cortisol, but also many of these are actually side effects of high levels of cortisol-related administration medications, including increased levels of low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, so that's the more damaging cholesterol in the blood, chronic suppression of immune function, alterations of bone function, increases in abdominal adiposity, and so forth. So one can see a whole range of responses which might emerge if this psychobiological activation is prolonged or repeated under inappropriate conditions. So that's really the kind of rationale for trying to understand and study these psychobiological responses. The question is how one can go about establishing that and demonstrating that, and I'm going to show you two general approaches to doing this and some of the results which we and other people have found in this area to try and explain how this sort of thing works. It, of course, involves measurement of biological function along with measurement of psychological function and social processes as well. And there are two basic ways in which we try and study these things. One is to take an experimental approach, and the other is to do some sort of naturalistic kind of monitoring in people's everyday lives. And both these methods have strengths and both have limitations. The experimental approach is basically to stress people, to give people unpleasant things to do, and to see how they respond biologically. So a typical setup would be something as illustrated here. I've shown a timeline of the sorts of experiments which we do what happens to people during this. I don't know why this person's got a hat, but they come in with a hat on. They have various physical measures taken, you know, body weight, anthropometry, and body fat mass. We then put in a cannula in someone's vein, usually in their forearm or on the back of their hand. And that is itself, of course, quite stressful, so we then leave people quite a long time to settle down after that's been done, and so there's quite a long adaptation period here. We measure other things. This, for example, is blood pressure that I've just illustrated here. And so at the end of that, we will take some baseline measures and then take a baseline blood sample. What we then do in a typical experiment is to give people difficult things to do over a certain length of time, here 20 minutes, and then we take measures during that of the things we can, and then we take a further blood sample afterwards. Of course, they already have the needle in their arms, so they're not being interrupted by further venipunctures, and so we hope that what we see in the blood here is really just the response to the conditions we apply rather than further blood taking. And then we have people settling back, relaxing, I like to call it, but whether they really are relaxed is difficult to know, during an extended kind of post-stress recovery period with further measurements done over that time. What sort of things do we do during this period? Well, there are a number of different things we do. One type of stimulus that is used quite often is kind of what I'm doing now. It's public speaking. We give people simulated public speaking tasks to do, which some people find quite stressful. An example would be people are given a kind of scenario and then they have to give a short speech, a fairly unprepared short speech, and then we measure these biological responses. For example, people are told that they imagine you're just leaving a department store, Selfridges in Oxford Street in London would be an example, and just as you're leaving, the store detective puts his hand on your shoulder and arrests you for stealing some knickers. and you have to then go to the manager's office, and you've got 5 minutes to vindicate yourself, to show this was a terrible mistake, you hadn't stolen the knickers at all, it's a, just a state of mistaken identity, and that you're perfectly innocent. And so a person has a couple of minutes to prepare their speech, and then they give a speech for a short time, and that's videoed, and they're told that this speech will be rated for competence and fluency and how convincing it is. And so people find that quite difficult to do. Another example is a more straightforward kind of task, and this is just an illustration. You can see that there's a word in the middle that's meant to be in the middle of the screen, the word blue, which is printed in yellow, and the task here is to press a button which corresponds to the name of the colour in which the word is printed in the middle. So the word blue is printed, the yellow word blue is printed in red here, and so you have to press the right hand button, and you have that going along quite quickly, depending on how good your performance is. And you can see it's sort of complicated sort of task, and if people get good at it, then we make it harder. So these sorts of tasks are the kind of thing we do in the laboratory to try and produce a kind of acute stress response. I mean, you know, you think that they're moderately stressful, they're not staggeringly stressful compared with what many people confront in their everyday lives. Well, what we can do with this, well, what can we do with this? The first thing we can do is to ask about this issue of individual differences. So do responses in these biological processes vary with people's psychosocial risk profile? People who have more or less of these different types of psychosocial risk factor, do they respond differently? I'll just illustrate that with one example of a recent study looking at this substance called C-reactive protein, which is something which many people are interested in at the moment because it's an inflammatory marker, which may be a risk marker for cardiovascular disease. Well, it definitely is a risk marker for coronary disease. What's not quite so clear is what its functional significance is and whether it's just a marker or whether it's functionally more significant, but it seems to be related to low-grade inflammation. If someone is actually infected acutely, C-reactive protein levels are high, but that's a different process. What we're talking about here are variations at the much lower level. Don't worry about the rest of this stuff here. And it's a so-called acute phase protein, which is synthesized in the liver. Well, we did a study recently looking at how this might relate to work stress. So we stressed everyone, challenged everyone with the same challenges, but then we looked at variations in work stress. And so this particular study, as you can see, was carried out with just over 100 non-smoking men. And we were looking at this measure of effort-reward imbalance. So this measure here is to do with how much you invest in your work, how much you, how hard you work. People say that I devote myself too much to my work. When you wake up in the morning, the first thing you think about is work. Those sorts of people, sad people like me. And then reward, which, fortunately, being a professor, I get more of, which is to do with how much material reward you get or how much reward you get in terms of status and prestige. And you can work out an imbalance between effort and reward, and that's thought to be a factor which is related to coronary heart disease. So in this particular study, we used two standard tasks. One is that kind of public speaking task, another task I won't describe now. And then we take blood samples. And the issue is, are people who have higher levels of effort-reward imbalance more responsive as far as C-reactive protein is concerned? And the answer is yes, they are. What is plotted here are the increases in the levels of C-reactive protein measured in blood samples taken before the challenge, after the baseline, and then after the challenge. So these are stress responses, basically. These are change scores. And what I've done here is plotted these increases, which occur on average in everybody, in relation to effort-reward imbalance. So these are the people with the highest level of effort-reward imbalance, and these are people with the lowest. And what you can see is that those people who have higher levels of effort-reward imbalance have bigger responses in this marker, suggesting that there is at least an association between how people respond to challenges in their lives and this kind of inflammatory process which might be related to health outcomes. Now, a lot of our interest in our work has been in socioeconomic position and in socioeconomic inequalities, and in asking this question about whether socioeconomic inequalities stimulate these biological processes which are relevant to cardiovascular risk. We've done quite a bit of this work in this area in collaboration with my colleague Michael Marmot, and I'm only just going to give you a couple of examples of the sort of thing we've done. One thing we've done is to try and look at these responses in a population cohort, which is a difficult thing to do because these types of laboratory study actually take a great deal of work. Each person is seen individually, and they may be seen for up to half a day, and so the sample sizes we use are relatively small. But what we can do is to sample systematically from a population in relation to the process that we're interested in. And in particular, because we've been interested in socioeconomic position, we've been looking at members of the Whitehall 2 cohort, which many of you will know is a prospective cohort of British, initially originally London-based civil servants, who've been followed up now since 1985. So the people, when we saw them, were aged in their early 50s on average, and what we did was to sample people who are still in this Whitehall study from the different grades of employment. And this is just showing you the breakdown of grades of employment. These are the higher status civil servants, those who are in the administrative grades, people who are running departments and making decisions and so forth, and down to the lower grades, who are mostly office workers. They're white-collar workers, but they're in fairly low status jobs. And we looked at various types of biological response and tasks in the laboratory. Well, this is a typical kind of result that we've found in these studies, and I'm showing it to you because it actually illustrates quite an interesting point about these biological responses, which is to do with whether one's looking at the magnitude of responses or the duration of responses. What's plotted here is blood pressure, systolic blood pressure, the top one, and the two blood pressures that are usually measured. And these are average levels at baseline, average levels taken during the challenging tasks, and then at 15 to 20 minutes post-tasks, and then at 40 to 45 minutes post-tasks. So they do these challenging tasks, and then they just sit quietly. They either read or they watch nature films. The people working in my lab get completely fed up with David Attenborough, I can tell you, because they see it again and again. So they're just watching those sorts of things, but resting quietly. And what you can see in this experiment is that these tasks did induce quite a brisk response, an increase of about 25 millimetres of mercury pressure, which is quite a big response on that baseline, but that there was no difference by social position in the magnitude of these responses. You can see these lines really overlap very consistently. What did emerge, however, was this difference in the recovery period. So if we measure people's blood pressure maybe 20 minutes later or three quarters of an hour later, the higher grade people have recovered more rapidly, so that their blood pressure is down here at a lower level than these ones here. In other words, these people are showing a kind of persistent lower level kind of activation of biological systems, which is present long after the challenges are done and we've told them there's nothing else going on, we're just carrying on measuring you over this time. This is just another illustration of that same phenomenon, and it's just to illustrate it in a slightly different way. What this is showing is the likelihood, as it were, that people will show effective recovery in their blood pressure. So their blood pressure will come right down three quarters of an hour after they've finished the stressful tasks. And this is showing essentially that, for example, if we look at diastolic blood pressure here, that the likelihood of their blood pressure coming down is greatly, or likelihood of failing, their blood pressure failing to come down is greatly increased in people of lower socioeconomic position and moderately increased in people of intermediate socioeconomic position as defined by grade of employment. So we think that something like socioeconomic position, which is quite a difficult thing to get a handle on in the laboratory, may be associated not so much with differences in responses in this kind of variable, but differences in how quick and how slow adaptation takes place. Another example, I'll give you one more example of this sort of laboratory work, is using the the cytokine interleukin-6. The interleukin-6 is a substance which circulates in the blood, and it's produced by immune cells. It's also produced by fat cells and various other cells in the body. And basically, it's a signaling molecule, which higher levels of which have been associated both with not only with coronary heart disease, but also with a number of other health outcomes, including type 2 diabetes, depression, and disability. The research in this area is still at a relatively kind of early stage, but here, for example, is a recent finding showing relationships between high levels of depression, as defined by one of the standard questionnaires, and levels of interleukin-6 in a large population cohort in the United States, showing that people who are more depressed have higher levels of IL-6. We were interested in whether people who varied in socioeconomic position also vary in their stress responses in IL-6. And this slide here shows the results. It's a rather different pattern from the one I've shown you, and the reason is that IL-6 takes quite a time to respond, and that's one reason I wanted to show you this. It's not something which just goes up acutely during tasks. This is a longer time frame I'm showing you here, up to 2 hours, and this is where the tasks take place. This is where the blood pressure goes up but comes down fairly rapidly. IL-6 in the blood takes a much longer time to increase, and it's only at these later stages that we see differences between people of higher and lower socioeconomic position in the magnitude of IL-6 response. This is a no-stress control where the IL-6 levels just remain lower throughout. Well, so much for those experimental studies. I'll say something about how those relate to disease a little bit later on. But the disadvantage of that is, of course, you're bringing people into a very artificial environment. You're giving them artificial things to do. You're taking blood from them. And you're doing all sorts of horrid things to them, which are not typical of their everyday life. And so the alternative approach is to do what we would typically call naturalistic monitoring, which is to try and measure things as people go about their everyday lives. Now, these approaches have improved greatly over the last 10-15 years, and that's really been due to technological advances in the way in which we can measure different sorts of biological function. What we can do by naturalistic monitoring is to look at responses in everyday life, dynamic responses to things that happen in people's life, and we can look at the co-variation between biology and events and experiences. And the two methods which have been used most prominently are blood pressure monitoring with so-called ambulatory blood pressure measurement devices, and looking at the stress hormone cortisol in people's saliva. The blood pressure monitoring is fairly straightforward. What you have is essentially something very similar to the blood pressure cuff which is used in the doctor's office, except it's an automated version. So the cuff is put on the person's arm underneath their clothing. There's a box which is kept at the waist, and at pre-programmed intervals, the box stimulates an inflation of the cuff, and then there's a microphone in the cuff which works out the blood pressure levels. So people are going about their everyday life, and then suddenly this cuff goes off, and they have to obviously stop what they're doing, if they're doing something difficult, for that blood pressure measurement to take place. What sort of findings do we have with that? Well, this is a typical kind of finding one might see in relation, in this case, to job stress. One important element of work stress is the amount of control people have over their work. So people may have quite high levels of demand, but so long as they have sufficient control over their work, they may be protected. And by control over work, I mean people have a choice about how they can carry out the tasks, what order they can carry out the tasks, whether they can delegate responsibility, whether they can take breaks during their work time, and so forth. And this slide here is showing measurements of blood pressure, which we took over a working day, in people who reported high levels of job control and people who reported low levels of job control. I've averaged the data into four time periods here, but in fact the blood pressure was taken three or four times an hour throughout the whole day and evening, and these are aggregated values. And what you can see is that after we control for factors such as body mass and gender and concurrent physical activity, that people with high levels of job control have slightly lower blood pressure throughout the day. It just carries on at lower levels. Now, these are not large differences, but as I was saying earlier, when we're looking at these chronic influences, we're not really expecting very large dramatic influences. We're expecting quite small variations in activation, which, if they continued over months or years, might lead to future risk. The other measure I mentioned was salivary cortisol. This is a measure we can get from saliva, which we either get people to spit as they go about their everyday lives at different times, or we ask people to put dental rolls in their mouths. And this is a typical profile that we get with cortisol. Basically, what we usually do, in fact, is to have person, we ask the person, we tell the person when we want the measures taken. So in this particular study, we gave people 30-minute time intervals, windows, in order to take the measurements, and then we measured, they put the cotton roll in their mouth for 2 minutes, and then they put it back into a test tube. The saliva is, the cortisol in saliva is fairly stable for quite a time, so it can be actually returned through the post and things like that. This shows a typical profile. There's a waking response at the beginning of the day, and then cortisol goes down progressively over the day. And so one can again look at that in relation to psychosocial factors, for example, job control. And here's an example looking at from this same study, looking at job control, high levels of job control and low levels of job control, the cortisol profile over the day. And what you can see is that the people with high levels of job control have just slightly lower levels of cortisol throughout the day, throughout the morning and evening. Now, I've been talking so far about factors which are kind of bad things which happen to people. I want to just digress for just 5 minutes, if I might, on to something which is possibly better for people, and ask whether we can use these same processes for looking at more protective factors. And it's relevant because of the interest that's there's been, which I know some people in this audience share, in the ideas about positive psychology and happiness and well-being. And there's been a whole spate of literature about these types of process being possibly protective as far as mental health is concerned, but also as far as physical health is concerned as well. And I'll just show you one analysis that we've been conducting, looking at whether happiness or positive well-being is also associated with a favourable biological profile. What we did in this study, I won't go into the details of this, but essentially we measured people's affective state, so mood state, repeatedly over the day by using simple ratings. So we had people every 20 minutes, in fact, to rate happiness on a 5-point scale to about how they were feeling at that particular moment in time, from very low to very high. And by doing that, we then divided people out into essentially the proportion of time that people felt happy over the day. These data here are from a working day. And we can then divide people out, and this is a simple division of people divided out into 20%, so this, or quintiles. So this is the top 20% of people who essentially report being happy all the time. So throughout the working day and evening, they say they're happy. There are these glum people here who... 20% of the people essentially weren't happy ever. So all the way through the day and the evening they said they weren't happy. And then obviously we have some people here in the middle, and so it's a graded structure. I mean, I've defined it as being graded because I've divided people out according to their happiness. So the question is, how does this relate to people's biology? Well, it actually relates in an interesting way, which is, as it were, opposite to the more kind of stress-related or adversity-related effects that I described earlier. This here shows the salivary cortisol levels, again, on a working day. And this time I haven't divided out the times of day, so these levels here are averaged across the whole day. But what's this divided out is in terms of how happy these people were. So these are the happiest people, and these were the least happy people. And what you can see is that there is a gradient of cortisol over these variations in states of subjective well-being. So those people who said that, those people who did say that they were happy most of the time, actually had quite substantially lower cortisol, something about 30 to 40% lower on average than the people at this other level. What was interesting to us is that this was independent of many sorts of factors, including things like the social status, smoking, but it was actually also independent of distress. This is a measure called the General Health Questionnaire, which is a measure of psychological distress. So that in some sense, having a kind of effect on positive well-being was almost sort of independent of the negative effects of feeling bad, of being in psychological distress. And so it was quite an interesting finding. That's been published. What hasn't been published are these results here showing a 3-year follow-up of these same individuals. And what I've done here is to track from about 200 people initially seen, we followed up about 150 of these individuals and divided them out according to their original levels of happiness. So these are the people who originally, in that earlier graph, said they were happy, and these are originally people who said they were unhappy. But these levels are actually what they rated on a day 3 years later. And what's remarkable is how consistent it is. So these people here who said they were happy 3 years before are also still, on average, much happier than these ones down here who remain glum throughout this whole time, and 3 years later they still are unhappy, unfortunately for them. Not much difference, interestingly, between men and women in this pattern. These were ratings taken on a working day. What was also interesting to us is that the cortisol profiles, which we saw before, were by and large replicated. So these are, again, the original happiness quintiles. So this is the people who originally said they were happy and originally said they're unhappy, but the cortisols were measured 3 years later. But once again, there are higher levels of cortisol in these groups here and low levels in the happier individuals. And in addition, we saw a relationship with blood pressure as well, so that the people who had lower levels of happiness had slightly higher levels of blood pressure too. So I've explained that really as an illustration of the way in which these sorts of biological responses can be looked at, not only for studying more adverse effects, but potentially for looking at some of the more protective phenomena as well. And I won't show you this afternoon, but we've also done analyses, for example, of social support and things of that sort. There are problems with the interpretation of these data, and I think in the interest of time I won't go into these in any detail, but one of the problems with looking at cortisol is that, as you could see from the figures I showed you, there's a very wide variation over the day, and this means that if you just take a single measure, it's really rather difficult to interpret that unless you have it tagged in time, and so it's of greater interest to look at particular aspects of the day. And one particular aspect that there's a lot of interest in at the moment is the first bit of cortisol, what happens after people wake up in the morning. These unfortunate people, they have to take a cortisol sample as soon as they wake up in the morning, and then they take another one 30 minutes later, and they're not even allowed a cup of coffee in that time, which is really desperate. But they take that, and the cortisol does increase under those circumstances. Well, what we also can find out is that the response varies with social position, and the response also varies with day of the week. What's shown here are the average levels of cortisol when people wake up, and then 30 minutes later, on a working day and on a weekend day, in people who are high in socioeconomic position and lower in social status. And there are a number of interesting things which emerge here. First of all, there is this increase in cortisol as people wake up. Some people describe this as the "oh God" kind of response. You know, you think, "God, what have I got to do today?" sort of thing, and you start thinking about it, and then your cortisol shoots up. Which is bigger on a working day than it is on the weekend day. So when people are less challenged by having to get ready for work and getting other people in the family ready for work, then their cortisol responses are smaller. There is also this relationship with social position as well, so that the people of lower social status have bigger responses both on the working day and on the weekend day. And there's a gender difference, which I haven't shown here, which is that women have a bigger response on working days than men, but not a bigger response on the weekend days. And we think this is probably due to the fact that many women have to do more than just get themselves ready for work. When they get up in the morning, they have to get other people, such as their partners, ready for work, and not to mention children. Well, let me just touch in the last 5 minutes or so on this last point, which is to do with how these things are actually related to health. What I've tried to explain is that they could in principle be related to health, but we haven't actually been showing health outcomes from this research. And partly this is because this type of research is at a fairly early stage. Ideally, what you want to do, of course, is to measure these responses, to track people over time, and to see in an observational study which people might develop disease, or else you want to do an intervention and see whether that will alter your disease endpoint. And the fact is that these studies haven't really been going along long enough to look at many of these kind of disease endpoints. But I'll show you a couple of examples to try and illustrate how we think this might be working. The real issue when trying to look at these things is, do people who are more responsive show a more rapid progression of disease independently of the original risk profile? Do they get worse more quickly? And so looking at the variation either in the laboratory responses or in what happens in people's everyday life. The simplest way of doing this is, first of all, to do the kind of assessment of psychobiological responses of the sort I've described, and then to look at person's disease risk, and then to repeat that assessment of risk at some point later. So far, we've only managed to do this over a 3-year period. But even in that period, we can see some associations of the sort that we would predict, namely that people who may be more responsive in the initial assessment are showing more rapid progression of disease risk in the future. This is an example of a recent analysis we've done where we were looking at cholesterol responses. Blood cholesterol levels in the blood are obviously related to a whole lot of factors, but among other things, they do increase on average in response to acute challenges in the laboratory. This slide here shows increases in cholesterol in men and women from a baseline blood sample and then a blood sample taken after stress. And even though we control for various factors which might be related to cholesterol, there's on average a response. But it's quite a variable response. Some people show a big cholesterol response, some people show a smaller cholesterol response. So the question is, are those people who are more, as it were, stress responsive in cholesterol, are they at higher risk? And the answer is there is some evidence that they are. What is shown in this slide here is the change in fasting cholesterol levels over a 3-year period. So these are levels of total cholesterol, but they're not the ones you'll be familiar with because these are just changes from the baseline. So if someone was starting off at 5.2, for example, this would be a change up to 5.45 or whatever it might be. So these are different scores. And I plotted these against the magnitude of the cholesterol stress responses. So these people over here are more responsive to this initial challenge. These people are much less responsive to the initial challenge. And you can see that there is a relationship, so that those people who were more stress responsive are indeed more likely to show an evolution of cholesterol response. So what we think is going on here is that what we see in the laboratory in this case is that we're a kind of snapshot of the way in which a person might be responding to everyday life experiences. They're showing an increase in cholesterol, which will be a short-term increase. It may be a larger one or it may be a smaller one. But if those sorts of responses occur over, repeated over this time period, in this case over this 3-year period, then gradually that individual who is more responsive may end up being at higher risk in the end. It's a bit like, you know, none of these responses are important in pathological terms in themselves, but may, as it were, contribute to risk in the longer term. Just as a single cigarette has an acute biological effect but doesn't have a disease effect, but a single cigarette taken, you know, every half an hour, every day, every week, every month, every year, for decades, does have an effect because it's the accumulation of these small hits. It's the same sort of thing that we think may be going on here. One further example of this in relation to the metabolic syndrome, this is the same set of measures of metabolic syndrome. We can also see an association between the, as it were, the failure of blood pressure to recover effectively and progression in the metabolic syndrome as well over this kind of time period. So I've tried to explain how we might use these responses. I'm afraid I've skated rather quickly over how these responses relate to health outcomes. Let me just close with showing you the general kind of model in which we try to carry out this sort of work. We're assuming that socioeconomic position, as defined by these different ways in terms of a person's occupation, income, early life experience, and so forth, has associated with it a variety of psychosocial factors, some of which are protective and some of which are adverse. So the adverse factors may include such things as work stress, as neighbourhood strain, financial problems, and so forth. These may be offset to some extent by various protective factors, including social networks and possibly psychological coping responses, and also some more enduring psychological factors such as self-esteem. These same factors may influence a whole series of kind of mediators before they get to the disease outcome. They may have direct effects on psychological well-being, which I haven't really spoken about today. They may have effects on health-compromising behaviours, such as lifestyle factors, smoking, patterns of eating, and so forth, and also on these psychobiological responses as well. These things themselves are interrelated. I explained to you this afternoon how psychological well-being and the psychobiological processes may themselves be interrelated, but we think this may be part of the pathway, and the critical issue at the moment is how to really show all this going on at once. I've shown you bits and pieces, but neither we nor I think anyone else has yet been able to put this completely together in order to show every stage of this process, and that's something that we're hoping to do over the next few years, and it's something which I think the Glasgow Centre is also well positioned to find out much more about. And just in conclusion, I'd like to acknowledge various colleagues who are responsible for different aspects of this work. Thank you very much.
If you're asking a question, could you say who you are and where you're from? It's going to kick off.
Tom McMillan from Psychological.
Tom McMillan from Psychological Medicine. Your hypothesis is that if there are small increases in the number of different biological responses over time, this might have an effect. Would an alternative be that in certain individuals there is the likelihood of having a larger effect which goes over certain thresholds, and simply that could be an alternative explanation?
Yes, that's an interesting possibility, and clearly is a mechanism that's likely to take place in some people. Some of the other work we do is much more on the kind of acute end of disease rather than looking at these long-term disease processes, but looking, for example, at triggering of more acute illnesses such as people having heart attacks and so forth, where we can again see a possible role for some of these emotional factors in the shorter term. So I think both types of thing are definitely going on.
Alistair Leyland from Glasgow. To what extent might socioeconomic position be determined by reaction to stress? I'm thinking in particular of job interviews or whatever, where, have you got any kind of confounding there?
Yes, that's an interesting and an important issue which we struggled with a lot, because clearly if you're comparing people, what you're trying to do in a sort of standardized situation is give everyone the same stimulus and see how they vary in response. But if the stimulus is different for people, then you're getting a confounding. We actually spent some time looking at different types of challenge that we might administer to people in order to look for those which were going to be perceived, at any rate, in a similar way across social groups. That's one reason why when we've done work on socioeconomic position, we haven't used these kind of interview, public speaking types of tasks, because clearly people who are in the sort of higher levels of life and sometimes in public life are much more familiar with those sorts of challenges, and people in less affluent conditions may be much less familiar with that. So we've tended to use for those studies different sorts of challenges which we pre-test to make sure that everyone on average is considering them to be equally demanding, equally involving, equally engaging, so that we can then look at the variation in the biological response by comparing like with like. But it's definitely a very important issue.
Thank you very much for a very enjoyable talk. I'm Michael Gavin from Glasgow University. I'm intrigued by the interaction between the inflammatory response, particularly pro-inflammatory cytokines and potential development of, for example, infective disorders in the vegetative realm. Do you have a handle on what that interaction mechanistically might be?
It's not really my area, and so I think the easy answer would be no. But it's not clear to me whether it's this is a general issue in this area. Whether what you're looking at is a marker or is actually functionally significant. Now, cytokine responses are related to the activity of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal cortical axis, mm-hmm. and so it could reflect dysregulation of that mechanism, so it could be more a neuroendocrine mechanism, or else there might be some more direct influences. But I think it's difficult, because particularly if you're looking at something like IL-6, which is in the periphery in the circulation, then it's not clear why that should be influencing the central nervous system, the affective state, because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier.
There's some evidence. Can I just follow? I think that's a very intriguing problem, because most of these cytokines are too large, as you might say, yeah. cross the blood-brain barrier. There's some evidence, however, that their peripheral effect does cause some form of degradation of blood-brain barrier. So yes. there may well be yes. some direct interaction potentially.
I think there might be. It's been studied, as I understand, mostly with looking at IL-1, and there do seem to be some evidence that there could be some passage across the blood-brain barrier, or that there's some sort of autonomic nervous system kind of pathways as well, which may be important.
Thanks very much.
Carol Fannigal from the Basel Centre. Thank you for a very, very interesting talk. I just wondered if you could help us a bit with your thoughts on what the policy and practice implications are of this programme of research.
Well, there's one... I suppose there are two sorts. I mean, this is difficult. The first thing, I think, is that in terms of a kind of convincing people about the significance of social factors, it's very important to have biology present. I mean, if all one's doing is saying, you know, people who live in bad conditions feel bad, I mean, that's, you know, maybe a worthy end, and many people are concerned about that, but somehow there are other people who aren't so concerned about that, you know, because they think, well, it could be just a bias and all that sort of thing. So actually showing that you get a manifestation in terms of physical responses, I think, is quite an important factor for, you know, for the whole, the importance of this whole area as far as sort of emphasizing and convincing politicians and quasi-politicians about about these sorts of things. the other aspect, I think, is that you may end up getting a better idea about the way in which you could assess interventions as well, because, again, you can assess these things at many different levels, but if you are able to look at interventions as far as proxy biological markers are concerned, then you don't necessarily have to wait until you end up with people with some people getting disease and other people not getting diseased. You can say, well, this is important because we know it's altering this process, which we think is part of the disease process.
James Arnott from Basel City Council and the Centre. I'm interested in people who maybe change their economic position or socioeconomic position, and how that works in your studies. For example, in your white hall work, people who are now an intermediate but were a lower class person, or someone who is now a higher grade and was intermediate, and any conclusions you can draw from that, and possibly also about changes in people's physical environment and the quality of, say, the housing which they live in, or the wider environment. Any points you can draw from that?
Those are interesting points. They're not, unfortunately, things we've really studied actually so far, but it would be interesting to look at that. I mean, the sample size we have at the moment are relatively small for doing that kind of work. What we have done recently, however, is to look at changes in people's kind of experienced economic position in relation to these biological responses. We did an analysis recently where we looked at people's reports of financial strain. This is to do with whether or not they feel they have enough to make ends meet, to pay the bills at the end of the month, and so forth. And we looked over our three-year data at people who said that their situation improved and those who said their situation had either got worse or hadn't changed. And when we looked at people's blood pressure over the day, there was, and cortisol over the day, there was in fact a fractionation of those things. So those people whose situation had improved actually had lower levels of cortisol, lower levels of blood pressure over the day. And so it's possible that we would see that kind of tracking, but it's not something we've really looked at very much yet.
Can we ask Keith Miller to respond? He's a professor of psychology at Glasgow University, and as always in these lectures, we would ask him to summarise and reflect back his thoughts.
A daunting prospect. Okay, I have some slides prepared. Can we, Andrew, do you want to kill that while we've enjoyed your presentation enormously. It was a real joy and a tremendous tutorial on a subject which, although for some of us here it's a familiar subject, you presented some data which were absolutely terrific. I think I'll too also savour your description of a definition of a quasi-politician. I think that's something that will linger in the memory here. You'll be relieved as an audience to know that I've been asked to keep this very brief, about 2 minutes. And I'm painfully aware that I stand between an audience and their free drink. I feel slightly better about that because I understand that the free drink is free non-alcoholic drink, and I can compound your misery by assuring you that it's a good 20 minutes to the nearest decent boozer. So I don't feel quite so bad about standing between you and that. What I'd like to do is just in 2 minutes, just to reflect on how what Andrew has told us resonates for Glasgow, and knowing broadly what he was going to talk about, I put some slides together. Let's deal with the stereotypes first, because we've heard about socioeconomic position and the possible implications for health that there may be. And of course, Glasgow stereotypically has been associated with really quite severe deprivation, appalling housing conditions, vandalism, despair, and so on. And we know that a large proportion of the population is socially excluded. There's a large amount of unemployment and general distress and despair. And one could imagine the consequences of that, given some of the slides that Andrew has just shown us. That, of course, is compounded by the Glaswegian, or west of Scotland, inability to cut down on the fags, the liking for strong alcohol, and a really quite appalling diet. I'm not sure if the deep-fried Mars bar is really apocryphal or not, but we all know that the intake of very fatty, high-calorie food, lots of sugar, is part of many Glaswegians' diet. And of course, the consequences of that, when compounded with lack of exercise, is obesity. But this being Glasgow, a silver lining can be found in everything, really. Now, those are the stereotypes, and it's worth perhaps remembering what the true picture is, because in Glasgow, and indeed across Scotland as a whole, very significant things are being done to tackle these problems. And amongst the most significant is a new housing programme, building decent housing for people, getting people to take advantage of the environment that they have around, and Glasgow does have an incredibly good environment. It's the dear green place is synonymous with more parklands than any other city, I think, in the UK. And there are many programmes to try and help people get control of their health behaviours, if you like, to support them in giving up smoking, to try and improve their diet. And the slide on the bottom left there is particularly relevant, I think, in the case of Andrew, because some of his other research, which he hasn't mentioned here, has shown how effective one-to-one programs, intervention programs can be in increasing people's intake of fresh fruit and vegetables. And we're also aware of the Centre for Confidence and Wellbeing that's being set up and is trying to maximise on what the potential may be for the positive psychology movement, if you like, in improving people's lot. And it's encouraging to see these pensioners too, beginning to do some aerobic exercise, although slightly disconcerting to see that they're also using it to rehearse for the Pensioners' Neo-Nazi Revivalist League. But again, that's Glasgow for you. Now, of course, with taking a more Glasgow focus, the big thing that's going on in Glasgow now is the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. And the remit of the centre, as you'll see there on the board next to me, fundamentally is to tackle inequality and to try to improve the city's health and indeed the broader city around the west of Scotland. And I'd just like to mention briefly two of the projects that the centre is involved in. They're very relevant to what Andrew's been talking about tonight. First of all, though, to mention how the centre is being supported, obviously in terms of finances from the Scottish Executive, but also morally, in terms of academic content and so on, from these other groupings here. And as a member of the University of Glasgow, I'm very pleased that a number of staff from Glasgow University are involved in the centre's work. Now, the two studies I'd like to mention, first of all, the SOVID 1 study. First of all, pick your acronym, get your acronym, and then you're away. This is a study of psychosocial and biological determinants of disease, and with Chris Packard from Glasgow Royal Infirmary at the helm. And it resonates extremely well with what Andrew has been telling us about the problems that lie in central obesity and inflammatory processes and their implications for vascular disease and also, we think, possibly for cognition and mental health. And the SOBID study, very simply, is involved in taking biochemical, physiological measures from participants. And notice this particular participant, for those of you in the know in health psychology, bears a disturbing resemblance to a very well-known health psychologist. It's not him, but the resemblance is remarkable. We're also interested in people's cognitive performance in relation to their various of these markers, and also their socioeconomic position. And apart from cognitive tests, we're also looking at effective state and so on, and their position in society. And a small group of the participants in this study will also go to the Southern General, if they agree, to take part in some studies to undergo brain imaging, to look in particular at the volume of the hippocampus, because, as Andrew mentioned earlier, that's one of the structures in the brain that may well be involved in some of the reactions we see, which may lead to or be part and parcel of ill health and poor mental health. The other study, just to mention very briefly, is the GoWell study, which is focusing on the positive implications for health of housing regeneration in Glasgow. And those of you who live in Glasgow will know well the Red Road flats, which are certainly not the best places to live. But with careful digitisation, you can remove them from the picture. As you know, they're going anyway, or have gone. And there are significant schemes of housing, of rebuilding, in the case here in Drumchapel. So that, taken together, the SOBID study and the GoWell study are focusing on Glasgow's principal needs and seeing how when these are addressed, how they may have implications for health. Well, that's what the centre can do, but I think those of us who live and work in Glasgow would say that probably the biggest asset we have here is actually Glasgow itself, because it's a remarkable city. It's over the last few decades, since it lost its position as the centre for shipbuilding and so on, it's taken some pretty hard knocks, but it constantly manages to reinvent itself. And it says something for Glasgow and indeed Glaswegians that a city that could have been so desolate in the 1970s and early 80s could turn itself latterly into the European City of Culture, the UK Centre for Architecture and Design, so on and so on. It's certainly a centre now for the arts and for culture. And one doesn't want to get too misty-eyed about the whole thing, but part of that really is also due to the people who live here. And these are going to be the participants in these studies, almost naturalistic studies, if you like. So Glasgow is providing for us, for those of us working with the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, is a very congenial laboratory and some very congenial participants. And from what we've heard from Andrew tonight, we're pretty well set, I think, to pursue some of these important leads that he's offered us. So I'd like to thank, put your hands together in the customary style and thank him again for a tremendous presentation.
Thank you all for your contribution for coming. Non-alcoholic friends, alas, are upstairs and there'll be people there to direct you in the Alexander Room. Just a final flyer for the next seminar, which will be held on Tuesday the 6th of December in the Trades Hall in Glasgow Street. Best-selling author, Professor Tom Devine from the University of Aberdeen, will be here to talk about the transformation of Scotland between 1990 and 2005, just how Scotland was trying to reinvent itself and what the implications of that historical process are for what we're trying to do here in Glasgow. So once again, thank you very much, Andrew and Keith, and we'll see you on the 6th of December. Thank you.
Diary shape, but it was all highlighted.
Oh, no, I never saw it.
Yellow and red highlights. No.
No.
No, okay.
Yes, I see you.
It's a beard on the face of it.